Chapter 6. Why They End. All eliminationist onslaughts end sooner or later, but not for the same reason. Why they end is an important question. Why they do not end earlier is perhaps an even more important question. Answering these questions requires us to broaden our view, to examine not only the perpetrators and their states and societies, but also their relations with other peoples and states. The effects of mass murder and elimination are well known. The perpetrators are roundly condemned and repudiated abroad, except by self-interested apologists. Less well known, discussed, and analyzed are the broader contexts in which mass murders transpire, which include the reactions of neighboring countries and the world. This is not because the topic is insignificant. The international environment critically influences political leaders' decision-making about people's fundamental rights within their own countries and abroad, and how, as a practical matter, they must govern and treat different people and groups. Witness the prominent and often dominant emphasis on human rights in international relations. During the past two decades, various countries, regional entities such as the European Union, and transnational and international institutions have encouraged countries to move toward democratic politics and free markets, positively influencing many countries, societies, and politics. We must reinsert our thinking about eliminationist and exterminationist politics into an understanding of international politics. Eliminationist politics is part of a world system of countries that, by acting or not acting, affect one another economically, politically, socially, and culturally, and over life and death. The formal position and claim that countries do not intervene in other countries' affairs has governed the international state system for generations and is enshrined as binding international law in the United Nations Charter. Nevertheless, 1. Countries' political intervention singly and in concert into other countries' affairs has actually been normal, and 2. Countries, by varied means, regularly signal other countries about possible interventions. States have always tried to influence the character of other states, societies, and peoples. Conquest and colonization have been staples of human civilization, including during our age. Countries successfully repulsing aggressors have continued beyond their own borders until the attacking countries sue for peace, often relinquishing territory, or are conquered, the offending regimes replaced, or critical features of state or society are altered. A central goal of international institutions and alliances, and of individual countries' foreign policies, has been to support and create abroad favorable political regimes and economic systems, and to undermine or prevent unfavorable regimes. During the Cold War, much of the world was divided into two camps, led by the two superpowers, with each side seeking to sustain its members' political and economic systems, undermine those of the opposing camp, and influence non-aligned countries' domestic politics and economics to make them friendlier. Today, many countries interfere in other countries' domestic politics by promoting democracy and free markets, among many more specific features of state and society. Such attempts employ the full range of political means available, from implementing military intervention or its threat, to imposing economic sanctions or their threat, to setting down political, economic, and social conditions and human rights standards countries must meet in order to make treaties, join international federations, participate in international organizations and commercial relations, to diplomatic initiatives, to public praise or denunciation. Regardless of whether such acts accord with international law and treaties, states have always tried to shape other countries' domestic politics and practices, and they have often succeeded. The notion that states must not intervene in other countries' domestic affairs and that sovereignty is inviolable is, in practice, ignored all the time. Intervention today is typically done in the name of freedom and other higher universal values and the rule of law, though it is often cynical cover for motives of political or economic power or advantage. Either way, intervention has been and is a common practice, and noble principles are put forward and often accepted as legitimizing justifications. States have been able to influence other countries' leaders who contemplate and then begin to carry out eliminationist assaults. Yet in contrast to all the other ways that states have claimed to be legitimately influencing the domestic practices of other states, societies, and peoples, political leaders have rarely defended the innocent abroad by seriously trying to forestall or stop mass murder, let alone mass elimination. The Genocide Convention. Until after the Holocaust, mass murder was not even broadly perceived as a problem, much less one that must be addressed politically, including in international law and treaties. The various Geneva Conventions, the first one signed in 1864, and other conventions for rights of prisoners of war long predated international conventions on the rights of citizens. This was not an accident. Soldiers needed protection because they fought to uphold states and their governments. But states saw no reason to protect the rights of non-combatants during war or of ordinary people in general not to be wantonly murdered because the state's own prerogatives to act as they wished would thereby be compromised. Political leaders wanted impunity to slaughter or to violently repress their own people as necessary, and to slaughter, expel, coerce, even enslave other peoples abroad. A world dominated by imperialist powers is almost guaranteed not to create laws, institutions, or norms for the prevention of eliminationist, including exterminationist, politics and practices, because imperialism depends upon the violent domination of conquered peoples and has a strong, almost ineluctable tendency to become eliminationist in intent and practice for many reasons, not least because of subjugated and colonized peoples' inevitable and ongoing resistance. This blinkered view of the necessity to safeguard certain small classes of people, such as prisoners of war, but not humankind's overwhelming majority, is not at all surprising in a pre-democratic era that denied the rights of all peoples to be self-governing. Until the second half of the 20th century, few rulers saw their people as citizens with rights. Instead, they treated them as subjects to be subordinated to the ruler's economic and political interests. The great powers practiced imperialism, so there was no powerful constituency for prohibiting eliminationist politics or even its mass murder variant. Only with the powerful impetus provided by the Germans mass murdering all over Europe, and especially the Holocaust's existential and real horror, did statutes against mass murder enter international law. In December 1948, the UN General Assembly passed its Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide, consisting of 19 articles, with the critical Article 2 stating, "In the present convention, genocide means any of the following acts committed with intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group, such as A. killing members of the group, B. causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, C. deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. D. imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group. E. forcibly transferring children of the group to another group." The government of any signatory country can bring a charge of genocide to the Security Council, which, if it first issues a finding that genocide is being committed, may then take such action under the Charter of the United Nations as they consider appropriate for the prevention and suppression of the acts of genocide or any other acts enumerated in Article 3, such as the attempt to commit genocide and the like. In its bare bones, the Genocide Convention seems to 1. outlaw genocide, and 2. call for intervention when it occurs. But its drafters crafted specific provisions to so eviscerate these two elements that the convention effectively does neither, and is meaningless as a working body of law and as a basis for action against genocide. This should not have been surprising if for no other reason than that one of the all-time most egregiously mass-murdering regimes, the Soviet Union, had veto power over the convention's content. Most severe and ridiculous are the definitional problems. The convention does not cover groups slaughtered for political reasons or as economic targets. It prohibits the mass murder of only national, ethnical, racial, or religious groups. The Soviet Union insisted upon this exclusion because, even as it was negotiating the convention's terms, its gulag was still fully operational. The consequence of this definitional omission has been even more catastrophic than it first appears. It allows any mass-murdering regime to claim it is engaged in a political struggle. The UN members wanting cover for their inaction can similarly pretend that mass murder's victims are not national, ethnic, religious, or racial groups, but political ones. Even more problematic is the Genocide Convention's failure to define genocide, let alone include objective criteria, such as a threshold number of people killed, that allow the international community to readily identify genocide while it is happening. This permits the world's countries to pretend that genocide is not being perpetrated when by any reasonable definition it is. In genocide after genocide, the countries that should have invoked the Genocide Convention circumvented compliance with its provisions by refusing to utter the word genocide. The United States did this in Rwanda, explicitly refusing, in full awareness of the actual events, to call the Hutus' all-out slaughter of the Tutsi genocide. The United Nations has yet to declare the Sudanese regime's ongoing genocide in Darfur genocide. Only long after any reasonable threshold of genocide had been crossed did the American government finally use the word genocide, and so the Americans nevertheless failed to urge forceful, effective intervention, and even worked to ensure that the United Nations would not adopt language that would suggest that intervention is necessary and obligatory. As much as all this robs the Genocide Convention of meaning and force, there is an even more crippling aspect of the definition of the phenomenon it purports to outlaw. The convention is clearly meant and has been taken to mean only enormous mass slaughters of hundreds of thousands or millions of people. So a regime may slaughter 20,000 to 40,000 people, as Hafez al-Assad's Ba'athist regime did in Syria, without the principal convention that purports to combat the enormous world problem of mass murder outlawing it. Indeed, the Syrian regime essentially had international immunity for leveling a good part of Hama and wantonly slaughtering its inhabitants. Or a regime that over decades murders a few hundred thousand people, as Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist regime did in Iraq, is not considered to violate this convention or trigger its provisions. Most mass murders do not, according to the convention's definition of genocide, qualify for international intervention. The de facto consequence of the convention, the United Nations Constitution and inaction, and international law has been to sanction a political leadership murdering 5,000 or even 50,000 of its country's people, particularly if done not too ostentatiously. The international community or some of its members may say that such political leaders are very, very bad people and eventually seek to put some of them on trial. But military intervention to stop the mass murdering would be without a legal foundation and therefore criminal. Another grave problem plaguing the Genocide Convention is its failure to treat genocide, more properly mass murder, as part of a continuum of eliminationist politics. Hence, ethnic cleansing, expelling huge populations while murdering only a small percentage totaling many thousands, does not fall under the Genocide Convention. Intervention is not triggered. NATO's interventions in the former Yugoslavia, first in Bosnia and then in Kosovo, came much too late after the perpetrators had victimized millions. When NATO finally did act, owing to mounting domestic pressure in Western countries and the desire to make sure the situation did not spin utterly out of control, NATO was without UN authorization and without the genocide conventions having been invoked. Indeed, international legal experts deemed NATO's belated intervention illegal because it lacked a basis in international law for outsiders to stop the Serbs from brutalizing, torturing, and expelling Bosnians and Kosovars from their homes and country and murdering them. If you, as a political leader, want to attack people for whatever reason, they oppose you, you consider them evil, you want to transform the country, then the international community represented by the United Nations and its powerful countries tells you that as long as you drive most of them from their homes, even if you kill thousands, for legal and political reasons, you will not lawfully face international intervention. As if all this is not debilitating enough for establishing an intervention regime that might work against mass murder and eliminations, the Convention's Article 2 defines genocide as the intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group. The Convention's crafters included the word intent as an artful and catastrophic dodge of the problem. A regime slaughtering hundreds of thousands can allege that it is an anti-insurgency campaign's collateral damage, or famine's unfortunate consequence, even if the regime willfully causes or fails to alleviate the famine. It can maintain it never intended to destroy one of the designated kinds of groups. According to the convention, such acts are not genocide. As I was composing this section, the United Nations issued its disgraceful report that the Sudanese government's colossal eliminationist and murderous assault in Darfur is not genocide and therefore does not qualify under the Genocide Convention for intervention. A regime fighting an insurgency that withholds food from a famine-ridden region can claim that the insurgency itself is preventing the food delivery and thus avoid international intervention because no intent to kill through starvation can be proven. Without a mass-murdering regime's secret records, it is almost always impossible to meet a legal threshold of proving intent. This makes it all but impossible for the United Nations to establish a legal finding of genocide while mass murder is underway, while acting against the murderers and saving lives is possible. The Genocide Convention's second colossal problem complements its foundational definitional problem to produce a political and legal climate of neglect, inaction, and all but total cynicism. It contains no effective enforcement mechanism. The convention must be invoked by the very states that typically have no desire to intervene to stop mass murders, and by some that want the killing to proceed. It contains no trigger mechanism such as a threshold number of slaughtered people. It relies on no authoritative body aside from the self-interested non-interveners, such as the Soviets for their own mass murders and those of other communist regimes, the Americans for the Indonesians' slaughter of communists, which the Americans green-lighted, the British in Kenya, the French in Rwanda, the Chinese in Tibet, the Russians in Chechnya. Even if the convention were deemed applicable to a given onslaught, it contains nothing but hortatory words to produce intervention. The member states may take action that they consider appropriate for the prevention and suppression of acts of genocide. Acting upon the Genocide Convention's provision to actually do something effective is essentially at will. The Genocide Convention has utterly failed to serve as a practical impediment to regimes slaughtering or expelling their peoples. In its 60 years, it has never been triggered or used for intervention, despite the many tens of millions of people that mass murderers and the practitioners of eliminationism have victimized around the world. It was not invoked for the Soviets' gulag, the communists' gargantuan slaughters in China, the Indonesians' slaughter of communists, the Pakistanis' annihilationist and eliminationist onslaught against the Bangladeshis, not for the Khmer Rouge's annihilation of Cambodians, for the mass murders in Burundi and Rwanda, the Ethiopians' killing of the people of the North, the rightists' mass murdering in Latin America, including the Guatemalans against the Maya, not for the mass slaughters and expulsions in the former Yugoslavia, Hussein's various mass murders in Iraq, the eliminationist and genocidal onslaught by political Islamists in Sudan, first against the country's southern dark-skinned non-Muslims, and then against non-Arabic peoples of Darfur. For establishing law adequate to what it purportedly wants to outlaw, and for mobilizing the world against exterminationist and eliminationist politics, the Genocide Convention might as well be in invisible ink. Its immense failure notwithstanding, the Genocide Convention was immensely important. It took the ad hoc law made at the Nuremberg trials of the Nazi leadership and turned it into general international law and formal norms. It is the only human rights convention that empowers UN members to intervene militarily in other countries to stop eliminationist assaults. It bolstered the foundation for the development of the international law of retributive justice by authorizing an international penal tribunal to try those charged with genocide and mandated, at least on paper, that perpetrators be tried. These provisions have led to the ad hoc criminal tribunals for Yugoslavia, Rwanda, and Sierra Leone, and recently the Permanent International Criminal Court in The Hague, an important development examined in Chapter 11. The Genocide Convention has also critically contributed, at least rhetorically and vaguely normatively, to creating a place for mass murder's proscription in the world's politics, both internationally and sometimes domestically, a break with thousands of years of practice. The international political environment's crucial context. With this in mind, we see immediately that our age has had various international political environments regarding mass murder. Understanding them depends upon delineating and analyzing, albeit briefly, the international political environment's four relevant dimensions. The first is legal. Is mass murder legally proscribed? The second is rhetorical. Is mass murder publicly discussed and brought to the attention of the world community? Is it loudly condemned, especially in the media and by governments? The third is action. Are outside actors, states and international organizations, permissive toward mass murdering, or do they intervene to stop it? The fourth dimension, related to and independent of the third, is hortatory. Do outside actors, by their public or behind-the-scenes stances, actually encourage certain leaders to commit mass murder, or support them when they do? There has been substantial variation on each dimension, and in the overall international political environments, these dimensions, legal, rhetorical, political action, and political exhortation, together compose. Regarding mass murder, four basic international political environments have characterized our time. Until after World War II, with the Nuremberg trials and Tokyo trials, and then the passing of the Genocide Convention in 1948, the international environment was all but wholly permissive of mass murder. No law proscribed it. Mass murder barely registered on the radar screens of governments, media, and public. Hardly a word was uttered against it. Little, if any, rhetorical pressure was brought against those implementing eliminationist policies. This was partly due to primitive technological and news-gathering capabilities and the virtual absence of truly independent media, which left events in many parts of the world unknown in other parts. But even when knowledge came to those who might have raised a cry, they said little, suggesting that better information-gathering capacities would not have changed things. The only partial exception was the condemnation of the mass murders that the two major international aggressors, Germany and Japan, committed. The Japanese Rape of Nanking in 1937 did cause an enormous international outcry, partly because of the West's racism against the Japanese, but also because of the butchery's sheer brutality, licentiousness, and shamelessness done in plain view of Western diplomats and newsmen. The Germans' mass murdering of Jews and others initially gained little notice around the world. The Germans' crimes and the upcoming reckoning was little discussed in the Allies' propaganda or in American, British, or other governmental organs' public pronouncements. After the war, though, it became a central theme of international discussion. During this period, the international environment, though nearly totally permissive toward mass murderers, generally did not actively encourage it. Murderous regimes were left to do as they pleased, though others did not spur them onward. The principal exceptions were the Germans, urging their satellites and collaborators to join the slaughter of Jews and others, and the Catholic Church, which around Europe supported the Jews' eliminationist persecution, though only certain portions of the Church in some countries actively supported the mass murder itself. From 1948 until the late 1970s, the international environment saw one positive change. One critical kind of eliminationist politics had become illegal, as the Genocide Convention formally outlawed mass murders classifiable as genocides. That aside, the rhetorical and practical permissiveness toward mass murder and elimination remained roughly as it had for centuries. A new development seen in earlier eras only in the transnational actor and at times sovereign country of the Catholic Church was outside actors' active or tacit encouragement of mass murder. This included Western intellectuals' legitimation of the Soviets and other communists' eliminationist politics, about which they could no longer deny, as they might have in the 1930s, they knew. Playwright Bertolt Brecht, philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre, and other equal and lesser luminaries supportive of this notorious eliminationist regime became known as fellow travelers. Still, whatever cachet these individuals lent, the two principal culprits in tolerating or welcoming eliminationist politics were the Soviet Union and the United States, within their respective spheres of influence. Each superpower helped engineer certain eliminationist assaults. The Soviets did this, before the Sino-Soviet split, in China and in its European client states' initial years. The United States did it in many rightist Latin American regimes, Chile, Argentina, and Guatemala included, and elsewhere, most disastrously, in Indonesia. Time magazine, in a 1965 article called Vengeance with a Smile, that reflected and further reinforced this view that prevailed in the United States, dubbed the Indonesians' exterminationist and eliminationist assault on the Communist Party's members the West's best news for years in Asia. The third period stretched from roughly the late 1970s until the early 1990s. The international legal stance toward eliminationism did not improve. Only mass murders that qualified as genocides were illegal. The rhetorical condemnation of mass murder did, however, increase. This was partly owing to American President Jimmy Carter's emphasis on human rights, and partly to the effects of détente and the Soviet Union's manifest decline, which meant that in the West, more people were willing to openly question the American government's neglect, not to mention encouragement, of client and supportive states' mass murders. Nevertheless, permissiveness prevailed, and no government, alliance, or group of countries, whether under UN auspices or not, seriously considered intervening in Burundi, Guatemala, Cambodia, Syria, Iraq, and other countries that slaughtered their own people. And despite more rhetorical condemnation, the superpowers continued to encourage or permit client states to murder real or putative threats to their power. The United States did this in Guatemala and El Salvador, the Chinese in Cambodia, and earlier the Soviets in China. One of the most bizarre and undeniably craven international stances of our time was, under Presidents Carter and Ronald Reagan, the United States' continued recognition of the eliminationist Khmer Rouge regime and its possession of Cambodia's UN seat, even after the regime's 1979 defeat. These presidents had no affection for these mass-murdering communists, but they were the enemies of the United States' even more detested enemy, the Vietnamese, who had installed the successor Cambodian regime. The contemporary period began in the early 1990s, after the Soviet Union's and most of the communist world's disintegration. The legal status of eliminationist onslaughts remained as before, with only those few massive annihilationist assaults that legally qualified as genocide being proscribed. The internationalized media, ever more able to quickly report events around the world, helped develop a greater self and public awareness of mass murder and eliminationist politics. The former Yugoslavia's protracted horrors on Western Europe's back porch hastened this by thrusting eliminationism under the Western spotlight and fixing the euphemistic ethnic cleansing in the global lexicon. General permissiveness continues for extensive killing in the developing world. Witness Saddam's Iraq, Sudan, and Congo, particularly when the eliminationist campaign is more grinding and gradual, a few thousand here, a few thousand there. Nevertheless, today there is greater public and political pressure for interventions, and there have been some, such as the counterproductive UN insertion of peacekeepers in Bosnia that enabled the Serbs' mass murdering in Srebrenica and elsewhere, NATO's subsequent more effective interventions in Bosnia and Kosovo, and the international community's forceful diplomatic intervention in Kenya to halt the post-election eliminationist assault on Kikuyu in 2008 that took 1,500 lives and expelled hundreds of thousands, and that could have escalated into a much larger bloodbath. The critical change is the drying up of outside encouragement for regimes to practice eliminationist politics. With the Cold War's dissolution, the global geostrategic rationale for the superpowers to encourage clients to commit mass murder ended. What remains are local and often stunningly petty reasons, such as the French political leadership's desire to promote Francophone peoples and therefore its active support for the Hutus' butchery in Rwanda. Exceptions to these general characterizations of the four international environments regarding mass murder and elimination notwithstanding, we have seen over the course of our time some progress in fits and starts regarding mass murder, though barely any at all regarding other eliminationist assaults. Yet the progress is meager if we use the reasonable standard that 1. All eliminationist assaults, or even just mass murder, are illegal. 2. The United Nations, member states, the international media, and attentive publics immediately and universally condemn them. 3. Mechanisms exist for powerful international intervention, including a legal basis for individual states to intervene to halt mass murder and eliminations within other countries. And 4. Forceful intervention occurs as soon as eliminationist politics begin. Instead, we live in the continuing, deadly hypocrisies that have characterized our era, a world governed by cynical leaders giving lip service to morality. We have let thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of people die without raising a hand or even seriously considering doing so. American President Bill Clinton apologized in March 1998, long after the fact, for having let Hutu murder so many Tutsi, saying that he and others had not realized the extent of the mass murder. Was Clinton saying that had the Hutu been killing, what, a mere 10,000 or 100,000 Tutsi, then his inaction would have been justified? Clinton's apology was cynical posturing for political consumption and for enhancing his reputation. While Clinton was letting Hutu butcher hundreds of thousands, he and his administration knew the facts for which he would later apologize. So why had Clinton enabled the mass murder? He was not willing to expend domestic political capital, especially after the loss of American lives in the short-lived intervention in Mogadishu, Somalia the previous year to save the lives of hundreds of thousands of Africans, men, women, and children. In Rwanda, Clinton made a calculated decision, not a mistake, which he actually articulated during the Hutus' slaughter, while covering his tracks by falsely portraying the all-out genocide as an ethnic conflict and, what's more, but one among so many other ethnic conflicts. In the commencement address at the U.S. Naval Academy on May 25, 1994, Clinton declared, "We cannot solve every such outburst of civil strife. Whether we get involved in any of the world's ethnic conflicts in the end must depend on the cumulative weight of the American interests at stake." Morality did not enter the decision-making, even as 1%. Clinton and his administration were so little concerned about the Hutus' mass butchery of Tutsi that, as he admitted in September 2006, "we never even had a staff meeting on it." Not until 1998, almost 4 years after the genocide, did Clinton see the necessity of trying to position himself as a moral man, gaining plaudits for his willingness to apologize, without ever owning up to his actual transgression. Perpetrators perpetrate with a sense of impunity from intervention or punishment. Such impunity is not much reduced from what has existed throughout our age and before. The creation of several ad hoc criminal tribunals, including ones for Yugoslavia and Rwanda, and recently the International Criminal Court, constitute in themselves little change overall, or even in eliminationist politics' overall legal status. It took the UN Security Council until March 31, 2005, 2 years or 730 days after Sudan's exterminationist and eliminationist onslaught in Darfur began, to take the minimal step of referring the situation to the International Criminal Court, though not as an instance of genocide, but as a threat to international peace and security, and owing to violations of international humanitarian law and human rights law. The International Criminal Court so far has been agonizingly slow in issuing warrants for only a small number of perpetrators, finally indicting the genocide's mastermind, Omar al-Bashir, in March 2009, though not for genocide. Yet the Sudanese government and its militias have killed perhaps 400,000 people and driven from their homes more than 2 million more. And the United Nations and the court's deplorably tardy and minimal reaction is for a political Islamic regime that previously committed an even more colossal exterminationist and eliminationist assault against southern Sudanese, for which the United Nations did nothing. Such small steps and such considerable inaction hardly inspire confidence in those who look to the international community to act effectively to stop mass murder and eliminations. Nevertheless, the International Criminal Court's establishment offers some promise of progress. Understanding the international environment and its evolution, and how it has provided a somewhat changing, though fundamentally continuous, context for mass murdering leaders, helps us understand why outside actors have not systematically stopped mass murders and eliminations once begun. Understanding the nature of outside actors with their different capacities is also important for comprehending what has happened and for thinking about how to craft more effective anti-eliminationist politics. Outsiders' capacity to intervene against mass murders and eliminations has increased substantially during our time. Modernity's enormous growth in state power generally, including technological, organizational, and monitoring capacities, has also applied to the power of states to work against eliminationist politics. Earlier, mass slaughters such as the Germans in Southwest Africa or the Belgians in Congo could go on for months or years before their existence or magnitude was, if ever, known to the outside world. Discerning the extent and effects of eliminationist assaults in faraway lands might be beyond the ordinary capacities of outside actors with few resources and little access in the region. Publix had little, if any, knowledge of areas of the world beyond their immediate geostrategic environments, and even in those it was often poor. If information gathering was one critical problem, then acting on it, even if the will to do so existed, was often extremely difficult and required substantial lead time. States' capacities to stop mass murders in distant regions were highly attenuated. Non-military means for pressuring other states were few and weak. Projecting power, especially far away, was extremely difficult. Starting a military campaign to stop annihilations would have taken a long time at great relative cost to states that had few financial resources. That is not to say interventions would not have been effective, especially in Congo, where the Belgians committed their vast mass murder over 2 decades. States today, whether neighboring states or those able to project power beyond their immediate environs, have enormously greater capacities to learn of mass slaughters and eliminations, and to intervene promptly and, in many cases, decisively. The United States and its allies routed the political Islamic Taliban state and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan in a few weeks, even if a powerful insurgency has since developed. Since World War II, the emergence of many international institutions and regional associations also establishes, at least in theory, an infrastructure that facilitates far greater international coordination to stop all kinds of eliminations. Today, there are many more potential actors. When European imperialist powers, which themselves often used eliminationist violence to suppress colonized peoples, controlled large portions of the world, mass murdering regimes had fewer neighboring states on their borders. As the past century wore on, with progressive decolonization, mass murderers had to potentially contend with both neighboring states and more distant powers who, in principle, could intervene. We have seen a growth in the availability of verifiable information about what is occurring in states' capacities to intervene and in potential interveners against eliminationist campaigns. We have also witnessed the establishment of international institutions, the United Nations, the European Union, NATO, and other regional organizations and international trade organizations, which in principle can act effectively against mass murder and elimination. International institutions have increased the world's capacity for intervention because of their power and their ability to facilitate states acting together. Yet we have seen almost no increase in intervention, and only small, though positive, changes in the international environment for eliminationist politics. Why? Because without a substantial change in the laws, norms, and pressures upon political leaders to change their calculus, business as usual has prevailed. Powerful considerations, often also put forward as justifications for states not to act to halt exterminationist and eliminationist onslaughts, have prevailed.